What has this year been like for you just in terms of your training? Because it's moved around a couple times. Has that been challenging?
It was everywhere challenge. You know, this year it was very hard for me. Very, very hard, you know. I really want to be inside the cage, you know. And, you know, this is my goal. This year I have to defend my title.
That was UFC lightweight champion Khabib Nurmagomedov, the undefeated fighter many consider the best pound for pound in MMA right now, and possibly of all time. It's been more than a year since Khabib last stepped into the octagon, but that changes Saturday when he takes on Justin Gaethje at UFC 254 in Abu Dhabi. Today, ESPN's Brett Okamoto breaks down the fight that looks like the biggest of 2020, a year that brought tragedy to Khabib's life, taking from him the man who made him the fighter he is now. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, October 22nd. This is ESPN Daily. Brett Okamoto, thank you for joining ESPN Daily, man.
Of course, Pablo, anytime.
So I bring you on because I need your help. We are rapidly approaching one of the biggest fights of this year, maybe the biggest fight of the year, coming this Saturday. UFC 254 between Khabib Nurmagomedov and Justin Gaethje.
Yep.
How excited are you for this thing?
Yeah, I mean, you said it right off the bat. Maybe the biggest fight of the year. You know, Conor McGregor did fight earlier this year, and it's easy to forget that because it feels like it was a billion years away. But
yes.
I think when you look at this one, you look at the storylines involved, you look at what's at stake, you look at how it could shape the landscape moving forward, and then just from a commercial appeal, I think this thing is going to be very, very popular in casual fans. It's going to garner their interest. So it has that big fight feel. For sure. I think when it's all said and done, we probably will say this was the biggest fight of the year.
So I am a casual Brett, and I know...
That's okay.
I know. Thank you for not judging me. I know it's a safe space with you, but I do know there are all of these storylines packed in this thing. So I want to start with how all of this even came together, because Khabib is considered the best pound-for-pound fighter in the whole sport. He's in the conversation for best fighter ever, and he was last scheduled to fight Tony Ferguson on April 18th. Obviously, the pandemic scrambled all of those plans. So what happened exactly, and how did that bring us to this moment?
It's actually a great place to start, Pablo, because the backdrop of this story is pretty remarkable. Khabib is coming off essentially a non-fight where he didn't fight a guy named Tony Ferguson. But it was the most cursed fight in the history of the sport. I can say that pretty confidently. The UFC tried to book this thing 5 times over the last 5 years. And the reason they continued to book it was because neither of these guys lost. Tony Ferguson, coming into 2020, he had won 12 fights in a row. And so everyone was saying, you know, coming into this year, it can't happen 5 times. Like, we know it's cursed, but there's no way it happens again. And then the pandemic hit. And this was actually the first canceled pay-per-view after the pandemic hit. It was scheduled in April. The UFC tried to salvage it. Khabib was in the U.S. actually training. He said, okay, where is this fight going to be held? It was supposed to be in Brooklyn. They found out it couldn't be in Brooklyn. They thought it could be potentially in Abu Dhabi. So he went. He tried to go to Dubai to make this fight happen. Didn't happen. Logistical nightmare, etc. They ended up moving on from Khabib, and in comes Justin Gaethje, and then he whoops Tony Ferguson, Pablo.
Oh, Tony's hurt. He's hurt real
he's
bad.
Real hurt.
Oh, he's
now.
Hurt bad. They're going to stop the fight.
Justin comes in and beats the guy that was supposed to be potentially the guy to beat Khabib Nurmagomedov.
That's it. Justin Gaethje stops Tony Ferguson in round 5. He's the UFC's interim lightweight champion.
I mean, that is the most amazing performance of Justin Gaethje's career.
It's a weird situation in that we had waited so long to see Tony Ferguson and Khabib, but now it's like, we're still kind of sad about that, but we're not too sad because Justin came in and looked just so great against Tony in May. And now here we got potentially an even better fight between Khabib and Justin.
So Khabib himself has not fought since September of last year. And since then, on top of missing out on the Ferguson fight, The coronavirus wound up at his family's doorstep back in his homeland of Dagestan, which is this semi-autonomous part of Russia. Explain to us what happened there.
An important thing to note right off the bat is Habib has had an extremely close relationship with his father, Abdulmanap. And Habib, the majority of his career, has been training in San Jose, California. He lives in Dagestan, but before fights, he comes to California and trains in San Jose. His father couldn't come with him when he did that. And then his father wasn't able to corner him at any of these events because of visa issues. So for a long period of time in Habib's career, we heard about this figure, you know, his father who had gotten him into wrestling and was really responsible for all the success that he's had in the sport. But last year, we really got to see him because Habib fought in Abu Dhabi, and his father was able to get to Abu Dhabi and corner him for the first time in his career.
You see Habib's father, Abdulmanap, right there, proud to be in his son's corner tonight. Nurmagomedov under the chin. There's the tap! Habib Nurmagomedov, 28-0!
Incredible. I have father here, my father. I want to say thank you for my father.
News started to come out late spring, early summer this year that Abdulmanap had contracted the coronavirus and that it was a serious situation because he had had heart surgery previously. He was having some difficulties with that heart surgery and then the complications from the coronavirus, and then he passed on in July. The sport of mixed martial arts kind of mourned his loss because of what he represented. He was just a very respectful guy, and he was really responsible for getting like a group of about 7 or 8 guys from that Dagestan region into the UFC. And in addition to that, everyone was wondering, you know, what would this do to Habib? When would he fight again? And how would he look, you know, when it happened? Because he just lost his best friend and his mentor and his father.
Do we know how he's reacted, how Habib has reacted to his father's death?
So I've talked to some people around him. He hasn't really talked about it. His coach out here in California flew out to Dubai for the last 6-7 weeks to train for this fight against Justin. And he was telling me, you know, he's sitting in the plane and he's like, I don't know what kind of Habib I'm going to get. I really don't know, because they hadn't really talked on the phone about the loss of his father. But he said, you know, it went about how I would have guessed, I suppose, is that we gave each other a hug and we got to work. And that's a good way to describe how Habib has dealt with it, is that it seems like he has just thrown himself into his training. The people around him said he doesn't really want to talk about his father. He acknowledges that, yeah, I lost somebody and it's very difficult, but he's a guy who kind of does it internally. And as far as how he's going to look on the fight, I talked to him a little while ago, and he said,
of course, it was very big challenge for me. This is like hardest year in my life. Who knows how I'm gonna feel inside the cage, because like physically I feel great, mentally I feel great too, but you know, like first time I'm gonna have like this hard situation when I go to the cage, and nobody knows, but my mental, my body, like feeling very good.
That's probably true of any of us. We wouldn't really truly know how it's going to feel when we walk out, but I thought it was interesting that he came out so openly and acknowledged it.
His dad was so much a part of his life in this sport. I just want to understand a little bit more, Brett, how Habib in Dagestan got into the sport, what his relationship with his father was like growing up, what was early childhood like for this pair of people?
Training camp, Pablo. Like growing up in a training camp is what it sounds like to me when I've spoken to Habib about it, and his cousins. His father was very, very well versed in this Russian wrestling style, and he basically ran a camp for these kids. When you talk to some of these guys who come from that region, they say that, you know, you can get yourself into trouble in Dagestan. It's a little bit of a war-torn situation. You know, they felt the effects of some of the things going on in that region. Like from a very, very young age, it gave them something that they were aspiring to. Habib has truly told me that he is looking forward at some point to the end of his career because he can be free and he can fly. His nickname is the Eagle. And he says, you know why I need to be free? Because I'm the Eagle and I need to fly. Because he really hasn't done that his whole life. His entire life has been dedicated to his craft, you know, and I think that obviously shows in the dominance that he's had. He's got this wrestling style that no one knows what to do with. They don't know how to counter it. The harder they work to work against it, the more tired they get. You know, I mean, Khabib's fights are really interesting in that they don't normally end like it's not, you know, that one punch knockout in the first round. It's just this drag you into deep water, make your life miserable.
He's got his feet tied up well. Look how good Khabib has done a job of wrapping those two legs up together.
Oftentimes, that type of style isn't very entertaining and fans don't take to it. But because Khabib's is so dominant and you can actually literally see these guys wilting and breaking under his pressure, his fighting style is entertaining.
Magomedov now working on a little bit of a neck crank, not under the chin.
It hurts, but it doesn't choke. It just makes things miserable. And that's what Khabib does so well, is he just makes things miserable for you. Hangs on your hands, beats you up.
It just creates this sort of tension in his fights that is he going to be able to get him down? Is he going to be able to get him down? And so far, throughout his entire career, he's been able to get these guys to the ground and then just do what he wants down there.
So in my capacity as MMA casual, I should confess that the one sort of data point I have on Khabib's training growing up is the fact that he allegedly fought a bear or would fight bears. Is this even real? Can you tell me where in this childhood training regimen wrestling bears came in?
Yeah, it is real. You can actually YouTube it and find it. And there is a young Khabib. And if I'm picturing it correctly, I think he's wearing, you know, a windsuit. Like he's wearing like the type of thing that like you and I would wear to like on our way to soccer practice when we were kids.
Right.
You know, he's got the tracksuit on. It's not a full size bear, as you probably could have guessed.
But that makes it a lot less impressive, Brett.
Yeah. I mean, it's like one of the lower bears on the regional circuit, you know, and
a real
and
tomato can of a bear. Yeah.
Exactly. And they're wrestling, man. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. Like the bears kind of gnawing at him a little bit, but it's like a full on wrestling match with a bear. I think it was just something that they did, you know, as part of their training. It wasn't just a one time thing.
So this coming fight against a human, Justin Gaethje, in what ways does this fight now take on some added significance for Khabib?
I mean, look, first and foremost, I think every fight is massive for Khabib at this point because he's undefeated. And that's what happens with any undefeated fighter, but particularly, of course, with one who has now won a UFC championship and is now talking about the end of his career and potentially finishing undefeated. Nobody does that, Pablo. Everybody loses in mixed martial arts, you know, because there's so many infinitely ways to lose in mixed martial arts. I think the second part is, yeah, of course, the loss of his father, it is a big, big deal. I mean, we're literally talking about a situation in which he has kind of listened and done whatever his father has told him his entire life. He's been known to fight emotionally, you know, in the past. And one thing that his father always said, it's actually called father's plan. His team talks about it. It's called father's plan. It's don't mess around on the feet. Get the guy to the ground as soon as possible, you know. And Khabib has not always done that. He has liked to play around on the feet a little bit, and that's when he could potentially get himself in trouble. I think it's a big, big fight for Khabib's legacy overall, and it will always be remembered as the first fight that he had without his father. So that's a big chapter in his career.
All right, after the break, let's get a little bit deeper into what we might see in the octagon on Saturday and how whatever happens might impact all of the other dominoes surrounding the sport.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Brett, let's turn to the task Khabib faces in this fight, because our colleague Mark Raimondi wrote this. There's no tougher matchup for Nurmagomedov in the UFC lightweight division than Gaethje. But at the same time, up until the spring, Gaethje, Brett, was kind of under the radar. So how did that guy get here?
He was a champion in another promotion. He was not fighting for the UFC for a really extended period of his career, which in some ways is kind of rare.
Gaethje cuts down Palomino with the kick. He might finish it off here. Gaethje has won it. He is still the champion. What a performance.
He was undefeated. He was known as extremely entertaining. The human highlight reel is his nickname.
Big right from Gaethje, and down goes Vic. Justin Gaethje is back and sticks the landing once again.
This is a guy who came from a wrestling background himself. He wrestled in college, and then he went into mixed martial arts and never used his wrestling. He just wants to stand and bang, is what we say, you know, right? He's a stand and bang kind of guy.
Beautiful left high kick from Gaethje, and Gaethje pushes him against the fence.
Oh, Gaethje's uppercut.
He's an adrenaline junkie. He's the kind of guy, he lives in Denver and he does backflips on his snowboard. I mean, that's the kind of individual that he is. And so when he came into the UFC, that was sort of the question. The question was, hey, Justin is super, super entertaining. You know, everyone in the UFC is going to love this guy. But he puts his hands down. He allows himself to get punched. Now that he's coming in and fighting the best, you know, what is he going to get knocked out? And he did.
Gaethje's hurt bad. Gaethje nearly out on his feet. Poirier continues to land. Dustin Poirier, goodness.
And it was at that point that, you know, Justin describes kind of being in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And he's like, okay, this has been fun. And I've made a name for myself. I've created a reputation for myself in which I know that I will always have a job. The UFC is always going to want me because I put on entertaining fights. But I've been doing that now for a long time. And this losing part is not fun. So my main focus is not going to be to entertain. It's going to be to win. Since doing that, he hasn't lost. And now he's fighting an undefeated guy in Khabib.
So you described a guy who used to be a very high upside, but also high downside fighter. And it sounds like that downside has sort of been modulated lower, getting him to a place where he could actually take out someone like Tony Ferguson, which had been unthinkable at a certain point. Against Khabib, Brett, what is going to make Gaethje so formidable?
A couple things. One is that I think the damage is important that Justin inflicts on his opponents. I think that when you're fighting a guy as dominant as Khabib, hurting him in a way that takes him off his game plan is going to be pretty crucial. I mean, Justin is a human wrecking ball. Like no one walks out of a Justin Gaethje fight not looking like they were in a fight, Pablo. I mean, they're limping. They're most of the times they are going to the hospital after you fight Justin Gaethje. The other thing is the wrestling. You know, I mentioned that he was a former college wrestler. He hasn't used it much in mixed martial arts,
right?
But he's very, very comfortable there. You know, he is a good wrestler, a better wrestler than a lot of the guys that Khabib has fought. And then the last thing is the cardio, man. I mean, he trains up at altitude in Denver, and he puts himself through these training camps that it's amazing that he ever makes it to a fight, because he just beats himself up and puts himself in the trenches for 8 weeks. And what that results in is just this cardio that he can go forever. And that is one thing that Khabib has always says, is that he loves to see his opponents get tired. You know, most fighters will say, I'd rather be even hurt than be tired. Because when you're tired, you just can't do anything. And Justin is a guy who rarely gets tired.
I just love that the choices you've outlined for opponents of Justin Gaethje or get super tired or be hospitalized, possibly both.
that's what you sign up for when you're fighting Gaethje and Khabib.
So if you're Khabib in this case, what are you doing to counter all of that danger that you just described?
Well, you're sticking to father's plan for one. You're not striking with the guy. I mean, Khabib striking isn't poor. Obviously, it's something that he's worked on and something that he's worked a lot on to get comfortable with. But you're not going to challenge Justin and his advantage, right? I mean, you're going to take the fight into your world. And for Khabib, that's on the floor. So first off, not getting emotional, not trying to prove a point, sticking to the plan, getting the fight to the ground. Justin actually described in another interview with another fighter's podcast, he's going to create a zone of death is what he calls it. And the zone of death basically extends about a foot in front of him. And that anytime Khabib enters that zone of death, he's got to make him pay, because if he doesn't make him pay, then Khabib latches onto him. I can't even put into words for you, Pablo, what it probably feels like to have Khabib grab a hold of you. I mean, just the strength that this man has, like once he even just gets a like an arm around you, you might be done. You know, it's just very hard to detach him once he gets into you.
I love any sport where zone of death is a phrase that is uttered both seriously and very consequentially. Like that's both a great branding move and also, I think, terrifying to me as an
that's
as
not
a spectator.
Trumped up fight talk, man. I mean, that's like that's very serious. I am creating a actual zone of death around my body. Yeah.
So Khabib, it does feel like the outcome of this fight can also hinge on Khabib's efforts to pin Gaethje up against the fence of the octagon. And for our listeners who may have never seen this particular maneuver, this sort of scene before, can you describe for us just how daunting of a challenge Khabib can be when he forces an opponent into that particular position?
Khabib is really, really good at pushing you against the fence.
And this is where Khabib really starts to get ahead from this position. Once he gets here, he doesn't let go, and he wears you out by putting all that pressure on your arms like that. It makes you carry his weight up against the fence.
When you're against the fence, man, I mean, you can't punch, you can't kick. Not only does it change the dynamic of the wrestling that's going on, but it also just neutralizes Justin in a way that, you know, more so than when they're out in the open. Because not only is Khabib kind of wearing on him and making him tired and threatening to take him down, he's not at risk to take any big shots really from Justin. Mm. And what people are going to see there is they're just going to see, as I mentioned earlier, Khabib is just stuck on you like glue, and you're using all this energy just to like get your arms underneath him, Pablo. Like think about like the hardest workout you've ever had, just to get your arms underneath the individual and create like 1 inch of space to turn him around. And that's like a battle for your life. And you might even get that, but then Khabib is so good at the next step. They call it chain wrestling, where he just goes to the next step. And so you work incredibly hard to gain an inch, and then right back, Khabib is put you in a worse spot than you just were. I mean, that's the kind of mental and physical fatigue that fighting Khabib has.
Yeah, you just described a perfect metaphor for 2020, honestly. That's how this whole year has felt. But I want to close by looking at how this fight might impact all of the other events on the horizon in MMA, because Khabib's at the top of his game right now. He is 32 years old. He is in his prime. He has a few good years of fighting left in him, I'm sure. But he's also been flirting with this idea of departing, retiring, flying away sooner rather than later. So how might Saturday's result impact what happens next?
Khabib is not going to be a guy who sticks around for, you know, the next 5-10 years. He's not going to be one of those guys who sticks around for the money. He could retire right now. He'd be fine financially. So what he's really going to be looking for is challenges. So if he goes out and he beats Justin, really, when you're looking at the rest of Khabib's career, you're asking yourself, what challenges are there still? And he's talked about George St. Pierre, the former welterweight and middleweight champion. His father really loved St. Pierre. I mean, St. Pierre, even if you're a casual Pablo, I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yeah.
You know, arguably the greatest fighter of all time as well. So, you know, of course, in Khabib's mind and in his father's mind, it's, hey, you know, when we're done with the title and we're thinking about departing, what better way to do it against a guy like George? So I think that fight is possible. I mean, George has said he's retired happily, but he's also said that is one fight he would come back for. And I do think that George would come out of retirement. As far as other options beyond George, I do think that this fight will have a consequence on Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now, if Justin wins, my guess is that the next fight would be Justin versus Conor McGregor. If Khabib wins...
Well, that's where I was going to go, Brett. I mean, I just watched Khabib on First Take the other day, and he was asked about a couple potential rematches, and he sounded really hostile to the idea of ever fighting Conor again. So yeah. Where are we with all of that?
So if Khabib wins and he still has a championship, he's coming at it from a personal standpoint of he doesn't like Conor and he doesn't want to give him the attention. But also, I think what really justifies that way of thinking in Habib's mind is he's like, that guy doesn't deserve a shot against me. I beat him in 2018. And since then, he has done what? He came back and fought one time against Cowboy Cerrone, who, by the way, Cowboy, as good as he is, and I love Cowboy, but he was on a 2-fight losing streak at that time. So I think in Habib's mind, he's like, he doesn't deserve it. I'm not just going to give it to him because he's Conor McGregor.
Fight for what? For what? For my legacy? I already beat them. Everything finished with these guys. I finish in a dominant position, you know, dominant with dominant performance. I need something new. I need something new blood, new energy, you know.
Now, if Conor goes out and beats Dustin Poirier, who is very good, Poirier is one of the very, very top lightweights in the sport. If Conor does that, then I do think that there's a chance that we could see a rematch between Habib and Conor. But if Conor doesn't do that, and he's still kind of like hoping that his name alone will get him a rematch with Habib, then I don't see it happening. I think there has to be a very strong competitive angle and an argument towards Habib to say this is why you should fight Conor again.
Man, there is no love lost between those two people, is there?
Absolutely not. I remember after Habib beat Conor, I remember I asked him ahead of his next fight, will it ever be done with Conor? Will that rivalry ever end? And he said, it will never end. Like, that is a rivalry for the rest of my life. Like, if I see him in person, like, I am fighting him and going to jail, basically, is what Habib said. Like, he's it's on site, I think, is what they say, right, Pablo, between those two?
Yeah, God, it's the whole world for those two men is a zone of death, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Brett Okamoto, thank you so much for making me a little less casual.
Anytime, Pablo.
Coming up, Aaron Rodgers, a fake fraternity, real flip cup, and a look at the most peculiar mind in football.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. Aaron Rodgers is nothing like other quarterbacks. Physically, he might be more gifted than anyone who's ever played the position. And psychologically, he is wired differently, like really differently. But we rarely see that wiring because Rodgers, perhaps wisely, is also one of the most guarded superstars in sports. Which is why ESPN's Sam Borden sought out the people who got to know Rodgers up close and personal over his 16 years in Green Bay. His backups. Sam Borden, you have an incredible story on Aaron Rodgers that dropped today on ESPN.com. I mean, I could spend this entire segment talking to you about Seneca Wallace and chemtrails, but there's somehow something even more incredible anecdotally than that. And it involves former Packers backup quarterback Graham Harrell, who I have not thought about in years. The dude is currently the offensive coordinator at USC, but there's a story you lead with that involves him and Aaron Rodgers and this fraternity they belong to. Tell me about that.
Let's be very clear. It's an imaginary fraternity that they belong to. It was a fraternity. It was a fraternity that Rodgers made up. This is what Harrell tells me. So it's 2010. Rodgers is in his third year as the starter for the Packers. Harrell comes in. He's the third quarterback on the team. Matt Flynn is the backup. Harrell and Rodgers hit it off. They get along great. They have a really good rapport, good banter. And at some point early in the season or in training camp, Rodgers says to Harrell, hey, we're in a fraternity. We're a brotherhood. Anytime Harrell does well in a drill, Rodgers will say, like, you know, way to do something for the brothers.
If I won the competition, be like, it's about time you did something for this fraternity. Or if I lost, it was I let the fraternity down. He liked to say, like, bro, you're getting paddled when we get back to the house. So like, come on, man. You know.
It's a long running joke. And Harrell, the thing that stuck with me, Harrell says Rogers took it so seriously. Rogers gave a name to the fraternity that he and Harrell are in. He decides that they're in Tau Kappa Epsilon, Teak.
This is already an insane level of Animal House cosplay.
Exactly. And so now it gets even better. So they're at training camp, they're going through drills, and, you know, they're doing this fraternity banter. And all of a sudden, one of the ball boys on the Packers kind of pipes up and is like,
what fraternity are y'all in? And I say, we're Teaks. He's like, no way, I'm a Teak. So I just went along with it, like, yeah, Teaks, man. And Aaron loved it. He thought this was the greatest situation ever.
Rogers is so excited. He's cackling. Like, it's all wonderful for him. So you would think, okay, it's going to end right there. But no, the ball boy's like, hey, I go to St. Norbert's College, which is where Packers training camp is being held. And we have a Teak chapter here. And we're having a mixer in a couple of weeks. And I'd love for you guys to come. Harrell is like, okay, clearly this is going to be the point where we're going to come clean and be like, hey, we're not actually in Teak. But Rogers is like, oh, we'd love to come. Like, there's no way we'll miss it. So fast forward a couple of weeks later, and the ball boy is on the bus with his fraternity brothers, go into this sorority mixer off campus at St. Norbert's College, and they get a text from Aaron Rodgers being like, hey, we'll be there in 25 minutes or whatever.
So at this point, I would imagine that like a million cell phones come out and this insane story of Aaron Rodgers at this mixer at what is, I believe, called the Carnation Crush. Like, this should be a thing that everybody knows about.
100%. I was like stunned. I'm like Googling as I'm talking to Harrell. I'm sort of Googling like, are there pictures? Is there video? And there's really nothing. And apparently what happened was, because Harrell and Rogers gave these guys a heads up that we're coming, the brothers said to all the people who were there, I mean, it was like, you know, 100 people, something like that. Hey, Aaron Rodgers and Graham Harrell from the Packers are coming to this party. Like, let's be cool. Let's respect them. They just want to hang out. And I mean, it seems almost impossible for you and I to imagine in 2020, but in 2010 in Wisconsin, everybody listened. And like, there is no visual evidence or video evidence of this ever happening. Then this is where the story gets even better. They get involved in a game of Flip Cup.
Of course.
With brothers from Teak against several girls who were there.
So they want to play Flip Cup with Aaron Rodgers. And so he's like, bro, let's go. Me and you were on, and we had a big team. I think I lost the team in the game because I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't make the cup land on itself.
Harrell just completely falls apart. Just a complete disgrace of Flip Cup aptitude. Their team loses. Rogers is super angry. He's like sharply yelling at Harrell, like, you know, you got to be better, you know, in this game of Flip Cup that they just lost. And Harrell's kind of like, I don't even know what's going on here. And then all of a sudden, like, this ritual is going on where at the end of the Carnation Crush mixer, the sorority queen is going to be crowned. Mm. And as part of the ritual, what do the guys do? The brothers get down on one knee and sing a song to her. And Harold's like, okay, now clearly this is finally the point. This has to be the point where we're going to be like, hey, we're grown men and not actually in a fraternity. So we're going to leave and, you know, not be part of this. And what does he do? He looks over. Aaron Rodgers is down on one knee, has his hand up in the air, and is mouthing words to a song that he doesn't know as a girl that he doesn't know is being crowned queen of the sorority.
All the guys have to get down on one knee and hold a hand up. And I'm like, we're not doing that, are we? And I look beside me, and Aaron's down on a knee with his hand up. And they're like quoting some queen poem. And he's just giggling like a little kid because obviously he doesn't know the poem. So he makes me get down and do the hand. And they're saying poems around us. And I'm like, this isn't even real life, bro. And he's like, yeah, he loved it. He thought it was the greatest day of his life, probably.
Oh, my God. Like, what does this say, Sam? What does this whole story say to you about who Aaron Rodgers is?
Obviously, it's an entertaining story. And I just love imagining like every element of it. But I do think that it is emblematic of a personality trait that clearly exists for Rodgers, and that is that he is somebody who likes to push and prod and just take everything to sort of the nth degree, even if at some point along the way it becomes a little bit weird and a little bit uncomfortable. And I think that's what happened for Graham Harrell and all the rest of the brothers at TKE back in 2010.
Sam Borden, thank you for establishing once and for all that there is no quarterback quite like Aaron Rodgers.
Thanks, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.